you very, very much.
Hi, I'm a recovered alcoholic. My name's Mike Chase. Good, he's still here. I'm gonna steal a lot of lines. Who's been in Alcoholics Anonymous more than 10 years? You know, there's only so many things a speaker can say from the podium. We basically just steal each other's stuff and use it in a different way. So I heard something this week that was really kind of cool. I'm here to comfort the disturbed, and I'm also here to disturb the comforted. I really hope that gentleman gets a sponsor tonight, gets somebody to take him and help him, because let's get to work, right? I need for God to kick me out of the way and sort of take over here. So I was taking a vacation a few years back, and I was up in Alaska. And while my mom and brothers were out looking at the majestic mountains and the great glaciers and the grizzly bears, I'm looking for a meeting. And I stumbled into a big book study. I think it was a Skagway, Alaska, something like that. And it was a real good meeting. Big book. And after the meeting, I started talking to this other guy. And I had been in general service at the time. I was the ACM, so I'm bragging about, you know, Fort Lauderdale having 765 meetings a week and all that. And he's going, we got two. And after our talking, he said, would you mind doing a prayer with me? And I said, sure, I'd love to. And he dropped down to his knees. And I thought, oh, my God, we're doing a third step or something, you know. So I dropped down to my knees. And the prayer he does, he calls it the fog light prayer. I think it and typifies, that's a real word, what we do here and why we're here. So I'm going to take a moment to get quiet, and you guys can just repeat after me. It's going to get me out of the way and give us a reason to be here. God, let your love shine through me like a fog light for those that are lost, for those that are sick, and for those that are dying, can find your love through me. Amen. Isn't that why we're here? Get right down to it. Bring the broken, the lost, and the dying back home to God so he can fix us. You know, I'm a big book thumper. I'm not even going to, you know, I'll just start off right away. I'm a big book thumper, and my job is to use the book to its utmost to get people through the process of figuring out, yeah, I'm a real alcoholic, you know, and my life is screwed. I better do something about it, and then we present them with the steps, and that's what my current life is currently. We did a really cool count, and I'm going to do a different one. Let's test everybody's arm. Everybody's arm working? Everybody put your arm up real quick. Come on, everybody. You can do this. Cool. Hi. Nice to see you. Who started drinking at age 3? Not alcoholic. Yes! You're my kind of gal. Would have loved you in third grade. Who started drinking socially at like age 4? 5. 6. 7. 8, 9, 10, 11, 12, now watch it, 13, yeah, it's a big head, 14, 15, 16, 17, 18, 19, 20, who had respect for the law? 21. Right? Oh my gosh, right? How many of you all immediately started suffering from that pesky little phenomenon of craving? Me too, you know? It took me a while for the whole mental obsession to kick in, you know, but let's get into my story. First of all, I'd like to thank the St. Pablo for inviting me, and Ron and Jim for all the work they put into this thing. And it's really cool to see real AA alive and well. We've got the archives here showing what they do. We have ASL here watching. Yay. Could you stand up for a minute? I have a niece, and she's also in ASL. And I asked any pointers to make your life a little bit easier. And could you just stand up here next to me for a minute? She told me a few words that I'm not supposed to use because for some reason I'm not sure. Could you... Could you just start texting in the same form? A couple of words.
Okay.
You ready?
Make it decent.
It's decent. Supercalifragilisticexpialidocious. How about, don't sit down, one more chance. Hula hoop.
Hula hoop.
Hula hoop. Yeah! Up here, right? Speaking of that, I want to start off currently. We'll jump into my story a little bit. Something I started doing just recently I got three folks that I'm bringing through working with others. Boom, 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 you know. Got them through page zero. The way I'm a Clarence Snyder kind of guy. Sit down with the newcomer, start on page zero, read the book one chapter at a time, start with the forwards, explain, spend 2 or 3 hours on each chapter, slowly get them through the book. When we get to the steps, we process the steps, and then we teach them, you know, and then working with others. And where was I going with this one? Wow, did that just go away? When I'm working with guys, I take them for the walk, you know. When I'm working with others, there's like 5 or 6 pages on your first visit. It's like, wow, that's a long visit. And I usually break it down to like just a walk around the parking lot. I meet them, get to know them, find out their religious, spiritual leanings, their drug usage, their family, ask them questions. You know, newcomers just love to be asked questions, and old-timers don't, but newcomers do for some reason. And then I get them to my house as soon as possible. You know, it's like, would you like to get them and read the book with me? And they go, what does that mean? And I said, well, we get together in my house. And they say, sure. I said, well, be at my house Friday at 5:23. Okay, so 5:23, they're knocking at my door. We come in and we start with a little introduction, find out what they're at. And then I ask them which package of recovery they want from me. They look at me like, what do you mean? I said, well, you know, I got 3 options here for you. I got it written down here so I don't screw it up. First option is called clean. The word clean is defined as a complete abstinence from all mood and mind-altering substances unless taken as prescribed by a doctor. Also, 90 and 90 mentality.
Okay.
Next, abstinence. The word abstinence means self-denial, temperance, continence. These nouns refer to restraint of one's appetites or desires. Abstinence implies the willful avoidance of pleasures, especially of food and drink, though it be thought to be harmful or self-indulgent. Self-denial suggests resisting one's own desires for that achievement of a higher goal. I practice self-denial to provide for my family's needs. I call that AA jail. You know, that's not working the steps. That's not getting it. But then I give the final, and this is my favorite, sober. The word sober means to have a perspective that is not distorted or out of focus. It is characterized by reason, sanity, self-control, and the state of being emotionally balanced. To be vigilant is to be watching, especially watching your step, so that each step is firm and well-placed. Sobriety and vigilance is proceeding in a wakeful state. It is a continual action of staying watchful and alert to danger or trouble. Not in an anxious way, but in a way that is securely focused, i.e. connected to God via the 12 steps of Alcoholics Anonymous. Who wants that one, right? Yeah. Best way to get that from what I've learned is from the big book of Alcoholics Anonymous, you know. I started socially drinking at age 6 and 7. My mom was a home ec major, and she would have these fabulous cocktail parties with, you know, fancy sidecars and whiskey sours. This is back in the 60s. And then she'd move everybody to the other end of the house where she had this great dinner party. And she would, get this, they would leave drinks in the living room. So I was 6, 7 years old. I'd pop up on the table because my heroes at the time were the Rat Pack, you know, Dean Martin, those guys that I just loved that whole idea of, you know, cocktail bars, bartending. I thought drinking was so magnificent, and it was for a long time. But I would pop up in the chair and I'd grab a little appetizer and nibble on that, and I'd reach over, grab one of them drinks, and get a little woohoo. You know, like, ah. But I liked sort of what it did, you know, a little buzzy thing going on. And I'd bounce around and finish them all up, and then I'd walk into the, you know, catch a good little buzz and walk into the dining room area and start singing and dancing, and they think that's cute, and I'd go upstairs and fall asleep, you know. Every time she'd have a dinner party, that was my thing. You know, bustle them up, get them all friendly with them, and then as soon as they take off, hit their drinks, you know. Not many consequences then, you know, and I lied. I didn't suffer from phenomenon of craving at age 6 and 7. You know, I suffered from the phenomenon of fun. I loved it. You know, I just thought that was really exciting. So I was always go upstairs and pass out. My life was that of privilege. My parents were upper middle class. I wanted for nothing. They gave me everything. I was raised in a very healthy Christian family, a loving, compassionate community. It wasn't far-right radical. It wasn't left hippie. It was just standard American Protestant, you know, just loved it. I went to nursery school, Bible study. I had this relationship with God. I was cool with the Jesus, and I was a good little kid, except I had this little particular habit I started to develop called lying, cheating, stealing, manipulation, you know, getting what I want. See, the stuff that I was given was cool, but I liked what you had better. I wanted more so I could learn to deal with. And I sort of look at my walk in life with my walk with God. You know, as a little kid, I was with God. I knew grace. I knew I had a thing called a conscience as a little kid, you know. And then somewhere along the line, me and God just sort of separated, you know. God was giving me great stuff, but Billy had a better bike, or Bobby had better toys, or there's some money, you know. So I started to step away from God ever so slowly. I was never one of those guys that, you know, gave the big guy double fingers and said, bug off. I just slowly became self-will run riot, you know. 8, 9 years. I was kicked out of choir, you know. Imagine that, you know. Nice little me. Speaking of nice little me, I was the kid that always had a black eye, you know, because I was that lying, cheating, stealing, low-life, self-centered, inconsiderate, backstabbing friend that had something that I wanted. And slowly over time, my little cocktail parties of my own, I soon started drinking a little bit more for fun. My father died at 8 years old, and it was sort of a tough time, I guess. You know, I remember the pastor came over and he tried to console us, and my mom said, why don't you take the 3 boys off and, you know, tell them where their dad's going to heaven stuff, you know, explain that stuff to him. So he sits us down and they were just going to the moon again, and he's trying to explain that when the rockets go through the clouds, you know, they're not gonna be able to look out the window and see your dad up there with the rest of the dead people. That's not how heaven is. And I'm just sort of like, okay, this guy's stupid, you know, I'm not that dumb. Seriously. And about 2 months later, Minnesota had one of those winter storms, and it was cold. And did I mention I was a hoodlum, you know, a vandalizer? Actually, our whole neighborhood was cool about vandalizing. And we were over at the neighbor's house that night. This was the alcoholic household, because they were never there, and there's always booze around, and the kids were into the mayhem. And we're sitting in the kitchen deciding whose house we're going to egg, what damage we're going to cause, you know, what horrible mayhem we're going to bring in the neighborhood. Soap a window, you know, some horrible, nasty, felony type stuff. And I reached over and I opened up the dishwasher. It was the kind that rolled around and you plugged it into the sink. And I opened it up and there's a bottle of vodka. And I'm a little nervous because I hadn't gotten my swirly yet. I hadn't got a snuggie yet. I hadn't been punched yet, you know. I'm getting along with everybody still. And I grabbed that bottle of vodka and I pulled it up and I looked at it. And out of the corner of my eye, I saw everybody in the room's eyes just light up. Like, no. Is he going to drink it? Is he going to drink it? And I take that bottle. Oh, good. Drama. Got that bottle. I take the little cap of it, and I'm looking at the guys, and I'm thinking, yep, do this all the time. Got this guy. Phenomenon of, I don't care what you think of me. That was my liquid spiritual experience. My life from that moment ever changed. That crowd used to scare the bejeebies out of me. I can say bejeebies, right? Used to scare me, and all of a sudden it's like, oh, I'm free, you know? And I drank so much of that vodka that night, I'm falling down the stairs, I go home and walk into the house, I just blah, all over the back porch, you know, just a beautiful vomit all over the back porch. I stumble upstairs, or I float upstairs, I don't remember, and I pass out, and I come to in the morning hearing my mom whooping on my older brother, John. You shouldn't be drinking, you're too young. And, hey, was it me? You are, you're the troublemaker. And I'm going like, ka-ching, no consequences. But boy, I found my solution that night, you know, and I chased it. But I tried to be social, you know, I always made sure that the bottle I had was pretty classy. Wasn't able to buy booze back in those days. So what I did, I just break into my mom's liquor cabinet and I'd take an old cough syrup bottle and I'd pour a little bit of this, a little bit of, I mean, I'm pouring a little bit of sherry, a little bit of vermouth, a little bit of blackberry brandy, a little scotch, and I'm just loving this stuff. Everybody else is like, can't drink, and I'm just chugging it down, a little sip in it, and I'm just floating, you know. And I start doing things I'm not supposed to be doing, you know, making mistakes, start getting some consequences. I start drinking more. I soon become an outcast with my friends because I'm that drunken. That's when the phenomenon of craving starts kicking in. I had not yet suffered from that mental obsession. That wasn't until a little bit later. I truly believe that, you know, alcoholism is based on the fact that my body metabolizes alcohol differently than the problem heavy hard drinker or the non-alcoholic. And the more times you trigger that actual phenomenon of craving, the way that it rewires your neurons, that's where that whole mental obsession comes from, you know. And so I'm doing pretty good, and start doing stuff I'm not supposed to do, and I find myself in a position of, like, I can't see these people again after what I just did last night. It was just one of the most shameful things I've ever done. And I'm driving by this time, and I had made the decision that I'm going to drive out to a field, put a hose from the exhaust pipe, and this is like 15, 16 years old, you know. Parked the car, ran the hose, put some Cat Stevens in, you know, because you can't kill yourself to fun stuff. So I got some really sad Cat Stevens, maybe some Carpenter music. Made myself a nice little bottle of whatever, and writing my suicide. You guys are gonna miss me. Oh, that savvy suicidal mood we get into, and something happened. Something got triggered. Guess what got triggered, you guys? What was that? Phenomenon of craving. Perhaps God, but this case was the phenomenon of craving. I started noticing my bottles getting empty. Well, that's unacceptable. I can't die without a booze. So turn off the car, put on some, I don't know, some exciting Van Halen, you know, and take the hose and put it back and go to the bar and continue drinking. You know, remember when Bill's life fell apart when the stock market crashed? His buddies are all jumping out the windows because they don't have any other choice. They know their life is over, right? Bill's living in the phenomenon of craving. He's just lost everything. He says, boy, I could use a drink right now. We'll fix it in the morning, you know. So off he goes. That's the life I'm at. I'm starting to live like Bill W.'s life, you know. And I'm starting to drink because I cannot stop drinking. I really am losing the choice. I from when I started drinking without adult supervision at age 16 to when I got rehab at age 24, I think I can count on the one hand the number of days that I didn't consume some form of alcohol. You know, it wasn't always to get blotto, but it always was to get me going. And I went to college based on the fact that the college town had rail booze for 35 cents, and the call stuff was 75 cents. I'm going to this college, you know, some little town, River Falls, Wisconsin. I ended up getting to three classes that year. Three classes, like 1 hour and a few weeks, a few months later, another hour and a few, like, and it's like, I learned how to dance because the floors lit up back then. But basically it was just drink myself through college. And when they asked me, or they said, you don't need to come back next year, I was like, cool, you know. I was the kind of drunk that would drink, and then all of a sudden I would just sort of pass out and get really obnoxious or throw up on myself, you know. So I would try to drink, but I would always end up coming to and getting some more. And so I dropped out of college, and my mom had some concerns about me, so she bought me a house to flip. But it was actually to keep an eye on me, you know. So I got this job in a biker bar. You want to learn how to drink? Get a job in a biker bar. So I'm a bouncer, bartender in a biker bar. And I learned the joys of hardcore biker drinking. And except I had that pesky problem of throwing up, passing out, and coming to and being a real mess. And then they introduced me to this stuff that was just, oh my God. Yes, I can drink some more. You know, first and foremost, I'm alcoholic, but, you know, there's some things I did in addition to that, like lie, cheat, steal, manipulate, and a couple of other things along the way. But boy, I'm passing out, and whoa, let's go on. I learned the joy of, like, competitive non-stop drinking for 2 or 3 days, you know, and I decide, boy, I can do this as an occupation. So I lose my job because they were getting in the way of my drinking and snuff, and did I say snuff? Cool stuff. And I was a really good consumer of my own product. I did it for about 2 years. I remember earlier I said that my heroes were the Rat Pack, Fred Astaire, Dean Martin, all those guys, and I had arrived, you know. 1983, I'm bartending, I'm getting invited to all the fancy parties, I'm being invited to the fancy parties because of my distribution business that's running. Oh God, it was such a bad So I still owe people money. I can't track some of them down. God. But my mom and dad decide to take a 3-month vacation. And by this time, I had lost my roommates because they were tired of my shenanigans. And the water was going to be shut off. The heat, I think, was almost shut off. The garage was filled with pizza boxes. And this is the house that we were supposed to flip. And my life's short in the drain. No one's really my friend. You know, I'm going to parties and, hey, it's me. Hey, nice to thank you. Bye. You know, I started becoming a lone wolf. It's funny. I had achieved, as Bill says, I had arrived. You know, I'm going to all the fancy parties. But next thing you know, I'm being only going to the fancy parties because of what I have to offer, you know. And I'm suicidal. I wish I was dead. My life is miserable. I never think alcohol is the problem. I think maybe that might be a little problem, but I don't know about, you know, that's, have another drink and move on. But my parents call and say, hey, guess what? We're going to Europe for 3 months. Can you come and watch the house? And I go, sure. You know, you have electricity and hot water. And they have this beautiful, like, 8-bedroom, 5-bathroom, beautiful, big-ass house. And so I moved in there. On the way to the airport, I'm giving a ride to the airport, and as we're getting close to the airport, my mom taps me on the shoulder and hands me a checkbook and says, in case of emergency. And here's some, I don't know if they had credit cards back then, but I'm just, it doesn't matter. So I drop them off, and I see their plane go whoosh. Oh my God, I got an emergency. And I run to the bank, and I, $50. You know, gosh, who needed to work? You know, my house turned into their house. We're having wheelchair races around the house. It's turned into this madhouse party. I'm not sleeping for days on end. I'm consuming more tequila than I know. All of a sudden, I come to about 2 months in. I go, whoa. And I realize I'm up to about $8,000 or $9,000 in emergency money. And this is 1984 when money was really big, you know, and that was a lot of money back then. And I was like, oh. Oop, emergency, you know, and off I go. And I decided to call cocaine hotline because that was my problem. They put me on hold. I got distracted. I did a line and started drinking, hung up on those people. I had a DWI earlier than that, and but that was because the steering wheel on this really old car, it wasn't because of my drinking, but I still had a DWI. And they sent me to Ding Dong Driving School where they teach you how to drive drunk and not get caught is what I learned from it. So my parents are gone. I'm all of a sudden, it's like a week before me picking them up, and it's like, what do you do? You know, I'm up to $12,000 in 1984 money. And I'll steal a bunch more. I'll just go to, I know I'll go to California. They'll never see me again. I'll just disappear with all this extra money. Dumb. I'll kill myself. Well, every time I tried that, thank you, phenomenon of craving, I'm still here. That never worked. And I'll just tell them I need help. You know, I heard of my friends that went to rehab and treatment, and I'll try that line, you know. Besides that, I was sort of getting tired of the uncontrollable drinking, the endless nights, the misery, the misery that alcohol brings us to, and I whatever. And my mom and dad, I'm supposed to pick them up at the airport at 8 o'clock, at 11 o'clock, they're tapping me on the shoulder like, where were you? The house had been relatively cleaned up, and we'll be downstairs. Okay. Not happy. And I went downstairs, and first thing I said is, I'm an addict alcoholic and I need help, but I don't know what to do. And immediately they had smiles from grin to grin. They knew what was wrong. For years, I'd go over to their house and have a drink and never finish the drink. You know, I don't know why. They never saw me in the throes of alcoholism. Oh my God, they're so excited. They could have done a happy dance. They would have, you know. And I stole $12,000. The hope and stuff like that. And a few hours so later, the phone rings, and it's this lady calling my mom about one of her books from Hazleton, you know. And my mom says, oh my God, my son just came out of the closet as an alcoholic. Can you help him? And they said, well, bring him over. So I went in and I got a little interview thing, and they said, oh, yeah, absolutely, but we can't get him in for 4 days. So they 4 days I'm trying not to drink, sneaking out at night to drink. My dad's catching me going, like, why don't you just quit drinking? It's like, I think that's why I'm going to Hazleton, because I can't. I think, I don't know. Ka-ching, I'm not going to jail. Cha-ching, I might get some help. I don't know what's going on, you know. And I go to Hazleton, and they showed me this packet stuff, and okay, and I was labeled an alcoholic. I started doing some packet stuff, and I was really bad at spelling and had dyslexia, and they said, that's okay, we're going to assign you a tech to dictate your packet stuff. And I'm like, cool, you know? And they're asking me questions, and I'm like, okay. Second or third night in there, I'm just like, what is this? They brought an AA meeting in. And I'm sitting where this gentleman is, you know, and the speakers are up there talking, and I'm sort of not really picking up, but I hear something, I see the steps and the traditions, you know, and I'm going like, 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, done, one, and I finish the steps before the end of the meeting, I think, and, you know, I got this thing down, and in the morning, pray on your knees and ask God to keep you sober. See, every time I had a miserable experience in my life and I take it to this conception of God that I had, I would close my eyes and I'd say, God, please don't get me out of jail. God, please get me out of, you know, it's like, and in my mind's eye, I would see this beautiful, warm, lovey light with this crappy shack-like wall that the light just sort of cracks through. And I'm thinking, God's on that other side and he's got this big-ass wall because I'm just this lowlife and he doesn't want anything to do with me. And I go to that door and I'm pushing, God, let me in. I need some help. I miss you, because I used to have a relationship with him. And the door wouldn't open. I'm just like, I'm destined to open my eyes. Oh, this sucks, you know. And I remember one night, third or fourth night, these AA guys had asked God. And I really had reached a moment of just utter frustration. I don't know what to do, you know. Hazleton with the blah, blah, blah packets and all that. Oh, my God. And I got up on my knees. Now, oh, by the way, I'm 24 years old. They put me in adolescent care with a bunch of 16, 17-year-olds. You know, this is how spiritually advanced I was, right? Bunch of young kids, and I get up on my knees, and I start praying. They're going, what are you doing? Shut up, I'm praying. Okay. And I close my eyes, and I'm getting all warmed up for some God time, you know, and there's the light and the wall. And it's like, crap, you know, and it's like, oh, hey, God, seriously, I am so screwed. I don't know what's going on here. Anything, please help me. I'm dying in here. Help me. And I go and push on the door. And I hear this, pull on it. Pull on it. Warm light just surrounds me. You know, I don't know how to describe it. Who's done acid, mushrooms, gas, glue? I woke up that morning, Captain Recovery, so blessed, so kind, so loving. Screw my recovery. What can I do for you? You know, I had just been this complete psychic change. I had started off that lying, cheating, stealing, low-life, self-centered, inconsiderate, backstabbing, don't want to be around kind of guy if you have cash to. Kind, considerate, understanding. I had compassion. I was just oozing love. And it's like, wow, I find out later. It's a, you know, the spiritual experience. And I was just, and like Hazleton's freaking out. They're like, oh my God, we got to have a process group. What's wrong with this guy? I'm up on the hills just chilling, you know? And they're like, what's wrong with this kid, you know? 28-day program, 26 days, Mike Chase is transferred to a 3-month halfway house program, right? 2 months into it, Mike Chase is put to 3/4 way, because I'm just the spiritual God. I'm just floating around, just happy, you know, Captain Recovery, kind, loving, and considerate, you know. And they're saying, Mike Chase, you should do the steps. And I'm going like, hey, white light guy, Hazleton, certificate of completion. I'm fine. You guys in AA, I did Hazleton. Too bad for you guys, you know, but I'm going to meetings. And I go to a big book study, you know, this men's group in this university trustees hall, these big old leather chairs and this heavy oak big table, and me and my other little guys go in there, and we sit down. This is the first time I've ever heard an AA meeting. I've done the therapeutic, blah, 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 how's your day stuff going, that was going on, but this is the first time I heard anybody reading out of the book and talking old school recovery, you know, and they got my attention. This is different. And on the way out, some old guy comes up to me and says, you know, we got them there special interest meetings for your type. You might want to start going there. I'm going like, listen, if you have a meeting that's centered around God in the book of Alcoholics Anonymous and some guy comes in who might be a little different than you guys, welcome him, you know? Because for the next 14, 14 years I'm struggling in the middle of the road, special interest, Alcoholics Anonymous. You know, I went 15 years without sponsoring anybody, you know. For the first year and a half, I'm walking in the sunlight of the Spirit, completely just God-centered, and it slowly just started working backwards. I noticed I moved down to Fort Lauderdale. Back in Minnesota, you know, everybody's sort of modest and new. Down in Fort Lauderdale, everybody's got fancy cars and fancy bikes and fancy houses and fancy clothes, and I just got this little modest job, and I start realizing, well, if I steal from work, I start doing this. Next thing you know, I start working the steps backward. I start building this thing of shame, guilt, remorse in my relationship with God. And God's doing his best to keep me. He's got me going to all these, like, sweat lodges and birthing classes and EST and the Course of Miracles and Unity and all this stuff. But back in the 80s, there was a lot of just, you know, 12 and 12 meaning maker makeits and get a discussion for the home group. And yeah, you know, I was on sex sprees, job sprees, shopping sprees, all types of sprees, but I wasn't, you know, occasionally my sponsor would say, so you're ready for them, there are steps yet? And I'm going like, hey, you know, white light guy. I was so lost, but I thought I had. I thought if I didn't drink today, I was successful. If I lied, cheat, and steal, but didn't drink, I was successful. I was so wrong. 14 years, I'm just ready to knock myself out, you know? Suicide starts coming back. I'd show up to the AA meetings to pick up my medallions, my 14 and my 15. And at 15 years, I was so untreated, so I was dying in the rooms of Alcoholics Anonymous, you know? I was so far out. And I went back to Minneapolis. I was going to check into the Marriott, buy a few bottles of Cristal, get some pills, and kill myself because this was not working. I was so miserable in the rooms of Alcoholics Anonymous. But I thought I'd give AA one more time. So I went to this big meeting and about this many people, you know, and I come in and like everybody looks at me like, who's he? You know, I've never seen this guy before. And I got the nods and maybe a little wave. Nobody came up. Nobody said, how are you? My name is, but you know, just sort of like they're so busy in their own crap, you know. And I came in and I sort of sat there and I left and said, AA don't work, you know. So I had planned. Listen, everybody you don't know in the rooms of Alcoholics Anonymous, you need to go introduce yourself. Make us feel comfortable, you know. I know I probably should have stood up and said, hey, my name is Mike Chase. I'm visiting from Fort Lauderdale. And, well, you know, I got a reservation to kill myself tomorrow night. Anybody got any suggestions, you know? Like, who does that, right? So the person who you don't know, make an effort to reach out to those people, you know, because I almost died. So I'm at this coffee house. I've got my plans. I managed to score some second all from a bunch of my friends who died. And I'm sitting there. I met somebody. And he said, want to go out for a beer? And I said, I don't drink, but I'll meet you for a cup of coffee. And he's like, OK. You know, so we went out and had a cup of coffee. And I'm sitting at the bar. And he's like, so you don't drink? And I go, no, I don't drink. And he says, really? You never? I've not for 15 years. And some guy just walked by with one of those Kraft Amheiser nut butter spiral roast pecan crusted craft beers. You go, but I've never had one of those. Can I try that? I'm like, what? And it's coming at me. It's coming at me. I'm going like, not a good idea. So not a good idea. You know, we have a seat waiting for you. It's like, oh, yeah, I'll just go back. No big deal, you know. I'm going to die anyways in a couple of days. No, who cares, you know. Ah. 13 and a half years of untreated alcoholism, shame, guilt, remorse. Whew, gone, happy, joyous, and free. Oh, God, I missed you. 3 days later, I'm sleeping in my car, you know, phenomenon of craving, pap right back. Couple weeks later, mental obsession just comes like that. I'm staying at my parents' house. They think I'm still sober, you know, with some mental illness issues because I'm such a whack, but seriously. That's me thinking. 2004, November-ish, my roommate is in fear of my life because I've been going on 3 or 4 day benders, lots of tequila, locking myself in the closet, which I had, or the garage, which I had converted into like this really cool party room. What happens in the red room stays in the red room type thing, you know. God, and he'd find me, you know, passed out in the toilet. And so I show up to work one day, and my boss comes up to me and says, your mother just called. Eduardo called. They have an intervention for you this Friday. Get your shit together. It's like, whoa. Oh, my God. God. See, God had been really sneaky because he put this little 5'4" knobby-fingered little guy who was like a big book thumper extraordinaire. Like, he was supposed to be doing sales call, and he's going like, so, have you reached out and helped somebody? Oh, hey, well, what does it say on page 5? It's like, I'm doing sales, and he's like doing this AA stuff all day long. I'm like, okay. And so I'm thinking, oh, dog poop. So I go up to him, and I say, hey, Ross, can you take me to that there meeting tonight? Sure. Yay, I get my toaster oven, I'm thinking. He's going to win something, you know? And I call my mom, and I say, Mom, I'm drinking and drugging again. But don't worry, I'm going back to AA tonight. And she says, oh, my God, we were going to have intervention. I go like, oh, well, you don't have to anymore because I'm back in AA. She's like, okay. Everything. So I go to the meeting. I sit down, and it's this really cool room, and it's really comfortable. And I sit down, and it's like, oh, I'm home. And it was so nice to be back. Oh, I'm home. And did you guys see those little cupcakes with the little cookie? Did you know those were chips? They gave me a chip, and they said, put this in your mouth, and if it dissolves, you can drink. And I'm thinking, good thing they didn't give me that one, you know, because I'd be drinking that night. But they gave me phone numbers. Got all this great advice. If you don't drink between meetings, you won't get drunk, Mike Chase. I was like, cool, thank you very much. You feel like getting drunk, give me a call, we'll talk about it. I was like, okay, that's cool, you know. You put the plug in the junk? Yeah. This is my favorite. You don't have to drink even if you want to anymore. And I'm like, oh, yay! And I got these phone numbers. Call me if you feel like drinking. It's like, yes, I will. And I hop out to my car, and I'm starting to leave the meeting. Oh, it's so nice to be back. And all of a sudden, the phone rings, and it's like, Monica, oh, yeah, I'll be right over. Because I'm waiting for this, like, white light experience thing again, or something similar, or something like that. It's like, yes, you're not ready for me to get sober, ha-ha, you know? So I was very delicate. I'd sort of show up to meetings late, and I'd leave early, and I made my best attempt to not screw anybody over, because I knew that the rooms were sacred. I was just there till everybody just get off my back. I wanted to get my job back, or that less, but I just wanted to get stuff back, you know? And about 3 or 4 months into it, back to drinking, you know, I sort of phased out the meetings entirely. Everybody sort of forgot about my little drinking issue, you know, and back to the same old stuff. I had gone on a prodigious bender of tequila, lots of worms, and I had become what's called some type of, can't say the word psychosis, cocaine psychosis, and I hadn't slept because of the tequila in my brain, and I'm seeing things, I'm just a mess. And I'm in the office pointing, you know, if you stare at your computer screen long enough, you can see this, and they're just like, what's wrong? I completely lost it, you know, and I ended up signing myself into, actually, I'd gone to the psych ward thinking that they were going to say, yes, you're right, that stuff's really happening, we need to tell everyone. And they're like, no, it's not, you're locked in here, you're not going home, and they kept me for 3 days, 4 days, 5 days. 7 days, they gave me a handful of pills and they gave me my dirty laundry and said, now walk home. And I'm like, okay. And I go back to the home group, which was going to be my home group, and I called up and I did the walk of shame, you know, to pick up my one more white chip, you know, okay. Got a sponsor. She was cool because she said, you know, I don't expect me to work the steps with you, and don't be calling me at all hours, and if I see you at the meeting, well, you can sit with me. It's like, cool, I got a sponsor, yay, you know. It was an IOP, which was really dumb because that just kept me from going to good meetings, and I was being treated for problem-heavy hard drinking in the rooms of Alcoholics Anonymous. They were telling me all kinds of things, get a service commitment. Matter of fact, 2 weeks back, I'm the general service alternate for my home group because I had 15 years before, do what you did before, do what you did before and you'll be fine. I'm like, yay. You can relapse on general service and they still don't kick you out. It's like, God. So I've got all these service commitments. I'm in AA jail. I wake up, I go to a meeting, I go to lunch meeting, I go to an after work meeting, I go to a late meeting. If I really feel weird, I go to an NA meeting at 12 o'clock at night and wake up and a hurricane would come through. Ooh, no IOP. You know, I got that whole thing down, how to drink and not get caught type stuff. But I'm showing up to meetings and I got this sponsor who's got a grand sponsor. He's like really annoying. He comes up to me and goes like, hey, Mike Chase, how you doing? Honesty's a bitch, isn't it? Just walks away. It's like, oh, I gotta pick up a white chip, and I'm struggling, and I got the service, and I'm reading the 12 and 12, and we're having these great open discussion meetings, and just white chip after white chip, and I'm becoming that person nobody wants to sit next to, you know? And I had a job, and I was handsome, and I was But I was contagious, apparently. Don't sit next to me and double up on your meetings. This stuff that was just, that we read in the doctor's opinion works great on probably heavy hard drinkers, but for the real alcoholic, therapeutic just doesn't cut it. We need to find a solution. That solution has to be God, and that has to be found through the book of Alcoholics Anonymous. So I wasn't giving that. We were giving everything else that. At this home group I was going to later on, they actually voted the big book out because they were taking the big, we'd stop the meeting every 15 minutes to jump in and read something out of the big book. And the trusted servants at the time decided, that cuts into our sharing time, so let's get rid of the book. It's like, wow, what had I stumbled into, right? And I'm on a run, and the phone rings. Oh my God, it's my sponsee brother from Alugia. Oh my God, I'm drunk. I'm not thinking. I answer the phone. Never answer the phone on a run, right? It's like, hello, and he's like, you've been drinking. It's like, no, it's the psych meds. They're not maxed up anymore. It's, I don't know. And he's like, you're drunk. And hangs up on me. And my sponsor calls and says, what are you doing? It's like, oh, my God, I'm drinking. I got to stop. And he's like, my grand sponsor calls. He's like, oh, I'm drinking. And I'm panicking because I know the AA SWAT team's on the way, right? They're going to come through, crash through the doors. They're going to grab my bottles. They're going to pour it down the drain. They're going to take my cocaine and float it in the wind and stuff like that. And I'm like, oh, chunking and snorting, drinking. Like, oh, and I pass out and I come to Monday morning. And it occurred to me that I am not ever going to stop drinking. This is my destiny. I am going to drink. I am one of those endless sots. I'm just going to keep drinking myself to death. And there's not, because AA stopped working. AA doesn't work. The God thing never happened. I'm just like, what is going on here, you know? I go to my home group. And halfway through the meeting, I stand up and I have a F-bomb. You tell me not to drink between meetings, but I F-bomb drink between meetings. You tell me put the plug in the jug. You tell me get a service come in, double up, and it's like, I keep drinking, I can't stop. What is going on here? Everybody else, and they're like, oh my God, he's going to kill us or something, you know? And there's this little guy in the back, Ross, Mike Chase, I'll bring you to the book. And I'm going like, yeah, I'm not going to do that. Can I talk to you after the meeting? Yes. Him and two other guys grabbed me, went to Panera, can I say that without breaking a tradition? Yeah. We went to a bread store. And 7 years, general service. They started talking to me what their alcoholism looks like, what a problem heavy hard drinker looks like that can stay sober off of fear, off of just fellowship alone, off of just good therapy. But you appear to be like what we call alcoholic, which is sort of the name of the program, right? Alcoholics Anonymous, not problem heavy hard drinker, have a open discussion, talk about it kind of day, but a real alcoholic meeting. And after that little conversation, I started going, that's me. We went out in the parking lot and they said, this is how you're going to stay sober. And they all just dropped to their knees right there in the parking lot. And they asked God to help keep themselves sober. And they pointed me, and you ask him to keep your sorry ass sober every 10 minutes if necessary, you know. Wow. I got together with him a couple days later, and he started on page zero. He explained to me what I always thought Alcoholics Anonymous was like a cool fellowship, a social club, drink coffee and hang out, you know. And he explained to me Alcoholics Anonymous is a bunch of people who were dying, who stumbled across the solution, which happened to be a relationship with God, and dang it all, we are the only ones who can help people, so let's go help people. It's like, wow, that's not what I thought AA was about, you know? And they sound a bit fanatical, so when he took me into the doctor's opinion, I found out what alcoholism is. It's a deadly progressive disease that's going to take us and kill us, and we're the only people who can help each other, which explains why these guys in the forward were so fanatical in the first place, right? Because they stumbled across a solution that was going to kill people, and we're the only people, wow, they get onto it. And I'm starting to get on fire. I'm not even thinking about drinking anymore, you know? I'm getting on fire, and we're reading the doctor's opinion, I'm like a little school going, that's me, I can't stop. Because I was labeled alcoholic, right? They never brought me through the book. I heard the bell curve, you know, the bell curve crap and all that stuff, but I never understood what alcoholism was, you know? Forwards, I learned what Alcoholics Anonymous was. Then in the doctor's opinion, I found out what alcoholism itself was, you know? And then they take me to Bill's story, which this is what it looks like. And they showed me what the progression, the solution, how it changed Bill's life. And I'm going like, wow. A couple days later, we meet, and there's a solution. See, Alcoholics Anonymous isn't a sneaky way to give us all the church. It's not like, ooh, we just found a way to get your money. No, it's like they stumbled across a solution for alcoholism that has to do with a relationship with God. And I'm like, wow, this is kind of cool. I remember I even dealt with the God issue in Bill's story. I remember Bill arguing with Ebby about God. And can you imagine Ebby's looking at Bill, you know, the wife beater, skinny, pants down to his knees. Bill, just shut up and get the God thing, right? Never happens. But he finally got his own conception of God, because Ebby was selling him one specific conception of God, and Bill wasn't ready to buy it, you know? Which is what the cool thing about Alcoholics Anonymous. We left the Oxford group a long time ago, you know? This is a God of your own solution, a God of your own understanding. So I remember in the more about alcoholism, I found out how really important it is to have this spiritual experience, because just knowing about it isn't enough. Not having the wanting to quit isn't enough. It helps us get started, you know? But it's that psychic change that can only be brought about by relationship or spiritual experience by God. And the description of Alcoholics Anonymous he had is sort of like a funnel. And people from all walks of life come to Alcoholics Anonymous. And we have this little narrow path called the 12 Steps of Alcoholics Anonymous. When followed specifically directly out of the big book of Alcoholics Anonymous, you come out the other side having a spiritual experience, and you can go be a Jew. You can be a Muslim. You can be a Baptist. You can be a Catholic. You can be evangelical. The purpose is we all come together, specific program, and go seek your own relationship with God, you know? So I walked into the We Agnostics going like, I'm cool with God. Got the God thing down. He said, well, then why are you still a mess? See, it wasn't just about my conception of God. It was about my conception as me as a member of society, me as a family member, me as a citizen of a group of people. How can all my aspects that I think about life be so screwed up that I'm such a doop-de-doo, you know? Oh, my God, I'm going to do the fourth step. When he finally brought me through the third step, we did the third step. By the way, if you've never read, we don't have enough time, but if you've never read the original How It Works, boy. You know, remember the ABCs? See, I don't like them reading How It Works at meetings because they leave the punchline out, which would be the old school. Our description of the alcoholic, the chapter to the agnostic, and our personal adventures before and after have been designed to sell you three pertinent ideas. That's why we read the book. It's specifically designed to get me to a point where I'm screwed, I'll do whatever you say. Eat a cat turd, how many, how often, you know? Thank God we don't do that. A, that you're alcoholic and cannot manage your own life. B, that probably no human power can relieve your alcoholism. And C, that God can and will. Here's the punchline. If you're not convinced of these vital steps, you ought to reread the book to this point or else just throw it away. That's the writings of Bill W. with God, you know, when he wrote that thing. This is serious stuff. When they went to Bill and said, Bill, you got to tone How It Works down a bit. You know, tone it down. It's too... And Bill's like, if they've read the book to this point, they know there's no other choice. They'll do anything I tell them to do at this point. And the therapist going like, well, Bill, you can't tell people musts and have tos. It's like, they're dying, they'll do what you need to do. And that's the way my sponsor presented this to me. You know, I did not look at the four step as, oh, it's like, yes. I'm going through the four step, and I come into the four step with this whole area that God is supposed to reside, filled with shame, guilt, and remorse, and every part of the step process just takes out a little bit of scoop, and I get more God. You know, the resentment takes out some big-ass scoop, and then the fears and sex, and next thing you know, I'm not disconnected from God anymore. I have a conscience. I feel what it's, I know what the difference between right and wrong, you know? The cool thing is I'm going through my four step and I'm not feeling, oh my God, this is miserable. I'm thinking, this is going away. I'm going to get better. So yeah, I had a week and a half before I did my fifth step. I wasn't running around going, oh, I just did my four step. I'm like, hallelujah, you know, I'm getting to God. This is so cool. And we went to the fifth step, and he pointed out all the stuff that I missed. It's like, wow, exciting, this is me. Six and seven, wow, you know. I now have a relationship with God. I know what the difference is between good and bad. Little secret thing we have in old school AA called the Four Absolutes, absolute honesty, purity, unselfishness, and love, which is sort of like a basic thing in all religions, but like we had to take it out of AA because it was like associated with the Oxford group, so we had to like remove it, and plus some of the guys didn't like absolute of anything, so. But fact of the matter is, I have a target, right? This letter A, and this is the four absolutes. In my life, I'm supposed to shoot here, right? Absolute purity and selfishness and love, right? But I got an arrow, right? And I shoot. The wind comes up. I shoot over here. Guess what? I've sinned to the right. I'm off the mark. My life, due to the fact I have a steps 10 and 11 of inventory, I know when I mess up. I missed 8 and 9. We'll get back to that. But, you know, they taught me in 6 and 7 that I'm always going to have character defects. But now I turn them over to God. And when I have the more powerful, healthy relationship I have with God, the quicker I am to go like, oh, I just lied. Oh, I'm cheating. Oh, I'm manipulating. Should I continue? No, I think I shall stop, you know? So I come out of 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, connected to God. First time in years, but I still got a bunch of people out there I screwed over. Can you imagine if we didn't have 8 and 9 and Bill's walking down Clinton Avenue with his newcomer going like, this AA stuff's really great, isn't it? And some butcher comes out and says, Bill W., you piece of poop, where's that $15 you owe me, you know? One reason we do the inventory is so we can walk around in peace. Another thing, it's the right thing to do. It's their money. It's their peace of mind, you know? We need to make right. And one of the things I didn't like is complete amends, you know? I'm into complete amends these days. So 8 and 9, he brought me through that. Boy, I can go anywhere in the world today and not worry about somebody tapping me on the shoulder, you know? That is quite a thing. How do I stay that way, you know? Yay! Step 10, I do a 10-step throughout the day. When I screw up, I have three people I can call. My sponsor, better be careful what fingers I use. My sponsor and two other people, usually people that will call me up. You know, not someone's going to co-sign. It's like, oh yeah, you were really bad there, Mike Chase. You need to do this, you know? So I go through my day. I don't wait till that other book tells you to wait till the end of the night to do the 10-step. I do the 10-step like the big book says, as I go through the day. Because if I screw somebody over at 8 o'clock in the morning, I ain't waiting till the end of the night to deal with it, because that's going to keep me blocked from God, right? So, the 11th step. Wow. What's the main goal of the 12 steps of Alcoholics Anonymous? To have a relationship with your own conception of? Thank you. So the 11th step is like the brass ring. Now that I've got this relationship, in essence, I tell my guys, my job is to get you sat at a little French bistro with God. Clean you up, get you introduced with God. What do you do with that relationship? What do I do with that relationship? Am I seeking God, or am I just like, you know? So I now join a church. I went church shopping. I went religious shopping. I'm cool with all types of religions, but I know God's out there, and everybody's concept. Everybody put up your thumb, right? Come on, put your thumbs up. Yeah, that's as many conceptions of God we have in this room, you know? All pretty general. Somebody told me there's 2,367 different words for the name that represent God, but it's God. Different views and descriptions of him. This is where I'm living today, step 12, you know? You guys ready for a little pop quiz? 58. Oh, yeah, work with others. Oh, this one's so great. So many people get busted on this one. This is out of the book, so don't get mad at me. Practical experience shows that nothing so much ensure immunity from drinking as intensive work with other alcoholics. It works when all other activities fail. Okay? This is our 12th suggestion. Carry this message to other alcoholics. What message? Practical experience shows that nothing will so much ensure immunity from drinking as intensive work with other alcoholics. Relationship with God, gimme. I'm loving the God thing, you know, but how am I going to stay sober and happy, joyous, and free? Working with newcomers. My schedule's packed, you know, hours on end, working with new guys, bringing them through the book, getting them connected to God. And I don't do that AA Munchausen syndrome where they're all connected to me and they can't, like, live without me for a couple days, you know. I get them connected to God, get them a little smack on the butt, and say, I'll get out there and start working with new guys, you know. That's how I got sober. Back in the days, you didn't wait a year. There's no law that says you have to wait a year to sponsor. Build it right away. I did more growing sponsoring than I did being sponsored. As I'm sponsoring, I'm helping them get through their situations, going like, whoa, I'm doing that too. And next thing you know, I'm not doing it. My first sponsee I got in the seventh tradition, fully self-supporting, declining outside contributions. I'm still getting money from mom and dad. And I'm telling this guy, mom, cut me off, you know? It's so hard to tell somebody to do something if you're still doing it yourself, you know? This is a program of action that has a direct result of an experience with God. It's an honor and privilege to be in such a cool room and have AA held in high esteem at a real Alcoholics Anonymous meeting. My name is Mike Chase. Everybody always thinks it's Mike Chase. You can't do that. No, that's my first name. The life I have is something I did not think I was going to get. The other day I had lunch with Susie. She was junior high school. Let's get high. Let's get cool. Let's get drunk. She could do crack, alcohol, drinks, snort cocaine. Problem heavy hard drinker. She puts it down. She gets on with her life, you know? Just, gosh, you know? But I did the stuff I can't stop drinking, you know? I'm a real alcoholic, and I recovered from alcoholism. I still could suffer from the phenomenon of craving if I trigger it so I don't drink. How do I stay sober? I seek and improve my relationship with God, and I actually have a program of action. I work with newcomers wherever possible. The most important person in the room is the one who's not connected to God. Thank you. Amen.
Who was that?
Thank you. That was awesome. Thank you so much.
Thank you.
Way to go, Mike.
Thank you.
That was good.